Senate Resource will come to order. Time is 4:15. We have Senator Green, McGuire, Stevens, Huggins, Wilkowski, and Senator Wagner. And Senator Stedman will be with us momentarily. We'll bring before us first today Senate Bill 80. And is Mary going to
present? Mary's going to present. We have three amendments, Mr. Chairman. That's Amendment M1, M2, and M3.
Okay.
And if there are questions on these amendments, Don Bullock is here from Ledge Legal.
Okay.
Okay. Put yourself on the record, and we're ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagoner, prime sponsor of this legislation. Mr. Chairman, you have before you the working document, just so we're all on the same page, as version M. It is the CS that was adopted a while ago. Mr. Chairman, do you want me to speak to the amendments, or do you want to?
Yeah, I'm going to ask Mr. Norman to come up and join you at the table, since he's our resident expert here today at the same time.
Mr. Huggins, Chairman Huggins, Mr. Bullock is here too.
Okay, no, understand. Okay, go ahead with your amendments.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to speak to all three of them? Do you want to move
Let's do one at a time.
Thank
right.
you, sir. We'll just take the first one first, since it's in order. M1 is an amendment that was dated March 19th. This is a result of a dialogue that was ongoing with all of the departments, their representatives, including Mr. Norman. And the standard practice of the industry will be deleted and inserted instead is good oil field practice. The committee also has a memorandum from Mr. Bullock that April 4th that was sent out, I believe, a week ago, that references that term, good oil field practice. And that is a term that was described in the Manual of Oil and Gas.
Okay, and we've previously discussed this with Mr. Norman. I think the AOGC is supportive of this amendment. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Is there any objections to the amendment? Okay, hearing none, the amendment carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You want me to speak
yes,
to number
please.
Three? M2 is a technical amendment, and this is a result of a conversation with representatives from the Department of Revenue, Mr. Iverson and Mr. Mintz, and also Mr. Bullock. And it's information that needed to be clarified. They're very technical in terms. Also, as a backup, is a legal memorandum from Mr. Bullock on page 3 of his memo dated April 4th. Is the discussion of the amendments for M2. Page 1, lines 2 to 4 and 14 to 16 clarify that the costs are not deductible. Page 1, lines 7, 8, and 17, 18 change the reference from a paragraph to a specific paragraph, I should say, rather than referencing the amendment to the entire subsection. Page 1, lines 6 through 18, clarify that language is in the uncodified section of the bill. And on page 1, line 21 through page 2, line 1, is a subsection that pertains specifically to the transitional provisions and how the interest would be paid.
Okay. Mr. Norman, any comments on that based on your previously having reviewed this amendment?
No comments. I understand the purpose of the amendment.
Okay.
No comment on that.
Right. So from your agency's perspective, it works?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Is there objection? Okay. Hearing none, the motion carries.
Thank you, sir. Amendment M3 is dated 4/19. This is the newest amendment, and this is a direct result of the Administrative Order 234 that was also provided to the committee.
Administrative
Order
2.
Yes.
We don't have M3. I don't have M3 either.
Okay, just stand by one.
It's in the front of mine.
While we're looking for the amendments, I just remind the committee members that the amendment process has been ongoing. The latest amendment we received was the 19th, which is, what, a week ago?
Yeah.
And all the amendments thus far that have been submitted are from Senator Wagner, you amending your bill, right? And as I recall, the first amendment came in right before we got a GIA, thereabouts.
Thank you.
Yeah, the first two.
Right.
I think we were into a GIA when we got the second one.
Got it.
Does everybody have the amendments now?
I don't have it.
Senator Wagner?
I got mine.
Got it.
Okay, everybody has amendment now?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Norman, please put yourself on the record so we...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Norman. I'm Chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I'm here in Juneau today to appear before Senate Finance, but have also been invited, since I was already here, to come to this meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. M3.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. M3 is dated 4/19/07. M3 came about directly as a result of the administrative order that was signed last week by the governor. But if I may, very briefly, this actually came to my attention through Mr. Norman's good stead some 6 to 7 weeks ago when he called and said, Mary, there is a draft administrative order going around to establish the PSIO.
Yeah.
And the PSIO is probably the one that will establish what our good standards for maintenance. And so we would then be able to identify what are improper standards based on those developed good standards. So we've been waiting until that administrative order came out. It did come out, and this amendment takes AOGCC out from the consulting group and puts the PSIO in there, because that's now the effect of the administrative order.
Okay. Mr. Norman, would you bring us up to date on your agency's affiliation with PSIO?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Administrative Order Number 234, the AOGCC in Paragraph 2 of the order is specifically one of the designated agencies that's part of that working group. And so I agree with Ms. Jackson. She accurately characterized it. And our thought was that in order to have the most efficient type of operation, it would be best to have one coordinating lead agency. And since PSIO is already set up by Administrative Order 234, and we are a participant agency in that, that would be a vehicle through which we could provide our advice and input in a coordinated way along with other agencies.
Okay. So you speak through them? Is that what you said, or they speak through you? Which way does it work?
Well, they would be the lead agency according to Administrative Order 234. So under that, we are one of the listed agencies under Paragraph 2 of the order, and we would expect within our particular area of expertise to have input side by side with the other agencies.
Okay. Any questions or comments by members? Okay. Is there objections to Amendment M3? Hearing none, the amendment carries.
Mr. Chairman, the only other thing to point out for the benefit of the committee is that there is then, as a result of the last action, a revised fiscal note from AOGCC, which is zero since they're no longer in that lead position.
Right.
Yeah.
So the question is whether we need from PSIO, do we need a fiscal note from them?
Fiscal note to follow.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think I can answer that. The PSIO is directly funded through the operating budget.
Right. Yeah, I don't understand. Okay, good. Thank you. So with that, thank you, Ms. Jackson. And now if we can go, Mr. Norman, if we could have you and in your former function, talk us through your analysis of the amendments that we have in the bill thus far, starting on page number 3. actually start on line 19 and carry through.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Can I just get a clarification on which version we're working off of?
Mike.
25-LS0425/M?
Yeah, right.
22107,
right.
Thank you.
And I will speak, Mr. Chairman, then in response to your question. To my understanding, at page 3 of version M or Mike, at line 21, pursuant to the, I'm taking these in the order that they arise here, pursuant to the amendment that's proposed, the AOGCC would not be a designated agency there because PSIO, as created pursuant to Administrative Order 234, already is an umbrella agency within which we would participate.
Right.
So it's not that we're being taken out of the process. Yeah, I see it as a streamlining of the process. At page 22, it would read, taking into consideration, and the words, the standard practices of the industry would be deleted, and instead it would say, taking into consideration good oil field practices.
Right.
And then the other technical amendments, I'm familiar with them.
You can bypass those. I would like you to go to line 26 and talk the members through line 26. The operationally, your perspective is our professional advisor.
Yes,
page 3 still, Mr. Chairman.
Page 3, yes.
At line 26, there is a subsection B, which would deny deductions for costs incurred to maintain the operational capability of facilities or equipment shut down because of lack of or improper maintenance of property or equipment. The AOGCC's only perspective on this, and this is purely a policy comment, and I want to preface my comment by saying that whatever version this comes out, we obviously are going to do our part to work to make it work out. But from the AOGCC's perspective, it would be desirable to leave operators maximum flexibility to effect repairs, necessary repairs, to equipment or facilities without having this general incentive to try to keep operating when perhaps the safest course of action might be to just do a total shutdown. That's purely a policy consideration, and I really am getting at the outer limit of what's proper comment from the AOGCC, since it's our duty to implement whatever you decide.
I've heard the analogy used that what Bravo does would essentially be like saying that I own an airplane. I do, a blue and white Super Cub, and it needs to be maintained, but I decide that I'm going to wait a while to do that, even though I know that it has a bad piston on one side and has a broken spark plug on the other side. And I put my son in the back seat and said, let's go bear hunting, and because I want to go shoot a bear. Rather than fix the airplane, I go try to shoot a bear and could crash en route to trying to capture Mr. Bruin. Is that how you characterize this?
That captures the thought, certainly. In some instances, in fact, in many instances, continuing to operate will be the best course of action, and presumably any prudent operator, that would be an economic incentive they would have, because you cannot make money just shutting down. So there's that driving force. The perspective that the AOGCC would offer on it, though, is that judgment about whether to shut down entirely, in other words, pull the car off the road, fix it, and then get it back on the road, as opposed to working on it while it's going down the road, is best left to the operator for safety reasons, for the purpose that the operator is the one that's going to bear the consequences if they don't affect a good repair also, and so they should have the flexibility. Now, under this bill, it's clear they still have that flexibility, but there certainly is a gentle nudge toward continuing to operate as opposed to shutting down a facility. And so our perspective, we have an eye only on safety, prevention of waste, things like that. An example, a recent example within the past 30 days, I believe that's right, about 30 days, was the North Star Field, where there was a gas leak there, and the operator elected to shut down operations there. From the standpoint of AOGCC's operations, we thought that was the most prudent course of action, although there were some alternatives that could have been pursued that we would not have objected to also, such as diverting the gas to some other method. Whether this would be enough of a factor in the minds of operators to cause them to continue to operate when the more prudent course of action might be otherwise, it really isn't a judgment I could make, but there is at least that potential. Keep the plane flying when the best thing to do would be ground it, fix it, and then go again.
Right. Questions for Mr. Norman on this provision? Senator Wagner, do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. The
Mr.
Chair,
I have some.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Green.
This is sort of a question generally under 19 A, B, and C. Are those all standard industry terms and terms of art that are clearly defined, or are there any incremental operating expenses or operational capability of facilities? Or are these in any way nebulous, or are they well defined?
Senator Green, through the chair, we are to a certain extent plowing new ground with this particular provision. The terms here would be given by, I think, the implementing agencies, and then in turn by the courts if they had to review it, their common meanings. So most of these, I think, an incremental expense. Now, as the old saying, the devil's in the details, sure. But as far as the plain words, I think they are understandable. There will be a need, as I indicated before, likely to promulgate some regulations to try to flesh out this term, good oil field practices, as best we can. And then there's still going to be a group of acts that simply cannot be anticipated without writing a code that thick, and on that we would have to fall back again on kind of general standard. But the oil and gas manual and in some of the case law and in some federal regulations, those terms are generally used. So we're dealing with things that are necessarily a little bit imprecise, because that's the nature of a statute. And then I think it's going to be up to the agencies themselves to take whatever you present to us and put some more specificity to it within the framework of what is given to us.
Thank you.
And on that point, just a second, Senator Wagner, on that point, the prevailing operational term, though, is good oil field practices. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. That's used in our Title 31, at least in one place, where we're required to determine if an operator committed waste. One of the things we measure against is, was this a violation of good oil field practices? So it's a term that we already employ for that particular purpose. Here it would be employed for different purposes, not just was the resource wasted, but would be employed for purposes of advising revenue. And it also exists probably in five or six places in our regulations, as well as in the regulations of some other states.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Norman. Senator Wagner.
Mr. Norman, one case I can see under this, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm familiar with the platforms in some ways and the way they work. They got a solar Centaur turbine out there. Okay. According to practices, and these aren't just good oil field practices. These are practices set up in manuals by the corporation that supplies and trains their people to maintain these turbines. And they require generally certain checks at certain times and so many hours of the turbine running. Very similar to an airplane turbine, basically the same thing. And the way I read this, if they do not follow the manuals and the proper testing and the proper maintenance on those, then these charges be disallowed. Or could be. I'm not saying it would be. Could be. And that stands to reason, because most of these companies don't want failure either. They, you know, these are expensive pieces of equipment we're talking about. They're not a nickel and dime deal. They're sometimes tens of thousands, if not more, in value. So that's the way I would relate A. Am I right? Or
I would agree with the way you've characterized it through the chair, Senator Wagner. Occasionally, however, there are not manuals. That's the point. So there we get off into an area where then we have to measure it a different way. The concern we had about standard practices of the industry, and the reason we preferred good oil field practices, is standard, does that mean what is the prevailing practice? Even there are some bad oil fields around where there are, and I won't comment on it within the United States, so I'll go over into Russia, for example. But some of those oil fields, if you went to what was a standard practice, that would not be acceptable at all here, even if they came in and said, hey, this is a standard practice. So we're looking at good oil field practices being a higher, more objective standard as opposed to what's specific to that particular field. And a final comment to Senator Wagner's question, that is the approach taken by AOGCC in enforcement actions, that if the operator has a manual and that manual specifies, for example, that pressures will be checked or certain other actions taken at particular times and they violate that manual, we have used that as a basis ourselves for going in and commencing an enforcement action. A lot of it will be, I think a lot of it will also, or a certain amount of it will constitute violations of regulations. In those instances, it's pretty clear if it's a violation of a regulation, but it's the area where there is no existing regulation and there is no existing company manual, and perhaps even what is best oil field practice is a novel question. That's where I could see this could get a little bit tricky.
So, but the term we're using is good oil field practice, not best. Is there a difference?
Good. Yes. And if I said best, I misspoke. Okay. Good oil field practice.
Absolutely. So you're good with good.
We're good with good.
Okay. All right. I got it.
Thank you for that correction.
Other questions or comments? Senator Green, did you get
That's
your
fine. Question? I just wanted to be good. Sure they good. Were standard terms.
Right. The chair is going to make a motion here, erring on the side of Mr. Norman's point on the airplane, my blue Super Cub, that it's better to not have an incentive that would cause me to keep flying it in interpretation. So I will move that on line 26, Bravo, that paragraph be deleted through or equipment on line 28. Do I hear objections?
I object.
Okay. You speak to the objection?
Well, I just disagree with you. I think that's an important part of this bill, and it has been, and I don't think it needs to be removed from there. I think it's perfectly workable the way it is. And I'd like to hear Don Bullock, the drafter, come up and speak to it also.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, could you remind us exactly what your change amendment was?
Yeah. On line 26. Bravo in Bowlegs,
right.
Deleting that paragraph.
Entire
through equipment, correct. That's the portion where Mr. Norman alluded to right. The flying the airplane that need to have maintenance pulled on it. rather than shutting down, there's an incentive to keep operating when it may not be in the best interest of either the operator or the state. Mr. Bullock.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Bullock. I'm an attorney with Legislative Legal Services. The paragraph or the subparagraph that you refer to has to do with what happens after there's been a failure. What happens after they have not maintained equipment to the level that you expect. So it's not, this doesn't refer to just maintenance in general. And these costs would be directly the result of a failure of the pipeline. That's what presents the issue of it's failed because of the standard lack of or improper maintenance. So what are the costs that flow from that lack of or improper maintenance? And if it results in the facility having to be shut down for whatever reason, then those costs that would not have otherwise been incurred, except for the lack of or improper maintenance, would not be allowed to be deducted. So it's not all costs. The way to prevent it is to maintain good oil field practice, which is the linchpin for the application of this section. So you never get to the issue of the need or not. But if there is a mistake that results in costs that wouldn't have otherwise been incurred, then those otherwise, the costs that would not have otherwise been incurred would not be deductible under fee.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Can you give me a concrete example? Perhaps Mr. Norman could. It's not coming clear in my head. If we take this out, what? Give me an example, real life example of it, how this will have an impact if we take this out, as opposed to if we leave it in.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I go back to the North Star field, the flow line, a gas leak. In that instance, the operator, I believe that was shut down for about 2 weeks. The operator thought that that was the most prudent course of action. They notified us immediately, and we agreed with that. And it allowed them to better perform diagnostics by shutting down. It allowed them to go in and effect a repair. There were some other options for continuing to operate, affecting a bypass, and continuing to do it. And I believe we weren't asked to opine on that, but I believe that if had that been the course of action, that would have been acceptable. But we thought the operator took a prudent, the most conservative, prudent, careful course of action, affected the repair in the best method possible, and then did get back into operation, and now that field is back up to full production. But the fact does remain that there were out of production about approximately 25 to 30,000 barrels a day for a couple of weeks. The limited point that I am making here is that I'm raising is a policy question, and that's what it is whether it's good policy, because there is more than this aspect of revenue. There's safety, there's conservation issues, there's other things. And to the extent that you want to incent someone to continue to operate because they know that if they keep their people on standby, keep the facility warm, it could conceivably delay a startup again if they know that they're not allowed to deduct those expenses. And the thing that focuses me on this is we are not talking about gross negligence. We're not talking about willful conduct here. We're talking about a mistake. And to be honest, mistakes happen in every single business. So if an operator makes a mistake and then they say to correct my mistake.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this isn't just a mistake. This is a mistake caused by their lack of or improper maintenance. So I see a big difference there. This isn't just, oh, we made a mistake. It's not our fault. This is they failed to take the proper action. And so we're rewarding them because they failed to take proper action. That doesn't seem like good policy for us as a state to reward them for that.
May I respond, yeah, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I understand what you're saying, but it's still a mistake. You go back to the root cause. It's not willful by definition, because in Section 6 you have that already, and it isn't reckless or gross, because that's already covered in Section 6. So we're down to somebody, some employee, failed to put in the proper lubricant, failed to change the gasket right, and suddenly something happened. And then, if it brings down the entire facility, that's a consequence, but it still goes back to someone made a mistake.
Well, I guess if I'm looking at this through a negligence and proximate cause lens, I suppose, and it happens. Someone was negligent, and the whole plant shuts down. Under the laws of negligence, you're responsible for it. And we're essentially rewarding negligent behavior. There's negligent behavior. We're saying you get to write it off. I don't think that's good public policy.
May I respond, Mr. Chairman? If in the context of a negligence lawsuit, through the chair, Senator Walkowski, I certainly agree with you. But insofar as you're applying tax policy, I believe that under the, and I would stand corrected certainly by Mr. Bullock, but I believe under the federal income tax, if you run a business and an employee makes a mistake, it's a business expense. Likewise, under, I believe, the Alaska corporate income tax, I believe businesses are allowed to deduct mistakes. Whether you're in the fishing business or a hardware store or whatever, something goes wrong, and you have to remedy that. It is recognized that in business, mistakes do occur.
I guess my point there is, but it isn't up to the federal law at all. It's up to the state of Alaska to make the determination of what they will and will not allow in the PPT tax bill to be deducted. That's the bottom line. That's the crux to the matter. And if you read this carefully, just the last six or seven words, it goes back and says was not maintained or was improperly maintained. And that's what most of our deductibles 1 through 19 address, are things we do not want to allow deducted from the taxes owed to the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, I fear I do not intend to be argumentative, and I don't want to get outside the area of the AOGCC, yep. And I right. certainly respect the policy right. responsibilities. So I think I've given you my perspective, okay. And I should just rest on what I said.
And Senator Walkowski, you had a...
Yeah, would they be able to deduct these, a similar error off of their federal taxes?
Well, you're not our tax man, so...
If anybody
through
knows.
The chair, I do believe that is the case, that they would be allowed to deduct it. But more importantly, as between partners, we've had some discussion on operating agreements, the relations between partners, and there is the provision in the PPT that has that audit provision. I'd have to work back through it and reread it, but ordinarily in a business relationship, partners will contribute if the operating partner makes a mistake. Because, I've never seen an operating agreement that said that if you make a mistake and you're the operating partner, the rest of us aren't responsible. It's generally, if you're the operating partner and you are guilty of gross negligence or willful misconduct, but not an ordinary mistake.
I don't know if there's someone from tax here who could explain it, but it would seem to me that they're probably not allowed double tax exemptions. In other words, they probably don't get a state and a federal. There's probably just one set amount that you get. So let's let them deduct the federal. They can deduct off their federal taxes, and then what does the state of Alaska possibly gain by allowing them to deduct it, other than they're going to get their deduction? This is kind of the way I see it. Am I wrong?
Mr. Bullock?
Yeah, I think we need to step back a minute and look what's underlying this bill. This is a tax bill. It's not about how to run an oil field. It's not what are deductible costs or what you should or should not do. The issue behind this bill, as well as all the other costs that are disallowed as deductions under the PPT, is that for every dollar that's allowed to be deducted, the state is giving up 22.5 cents of revenue. In addition, if it's a qualified capital expenditures, the state's giving up another 20% in the form of the credit. So it's 42.5 cents out of every dollar, potentially, maximum. And what this is it says, in exchange for giving the deduction of the credit in that amount, what do we expect back? Well, now, under the amendment you adopted, we're expecting that they apply good off-field practices. So that sets our reasonable expectations, that we're giving up some money. We're expecting that they do a good job of maintaining the equipment. Now, if they don't, then, like Senator Wilikowski says, if there's an event that causes harm, then the costs that flow from that event, which in this case would be triggered by some failure because of a lack of or improper maintenance, there'll be costs that will be associated with that event. And your policy, is this cost a direct result of that event? In which case, if they have to shut it down, the costs associated with that shutdown, and that shutdown only occurred because it had already been found to be the result of a lack of or improper maintenance. And B, which says, since that cost flowed from that event that we didn't want to pay for, then we shouldn't allow a deduction for the cost of flow. So that's what it is. It's really amount of state dollars and what the state will pay for by giving up part of its tax take and what the company would have to bear as its own cost.
Yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair, but John's a lawyer, and so, I mean, I think that the thing I'm trying to come to in my mind is that ordinarily, I mean, you have in these areas of law, there's the strict liability cases where you say, this is a standard, you violate it, you're strictly liable, and you don't have to go through the proof of that. It just is what it is. And it strikes me as though this is bordering close to that. So even though it's a tax issue, you are really forcing a company in going through and making its deductions to do that analysis of gross negligence versus negligence now. And negligence is really just, I mean, it's a very low standard. I mean, I just want to make sure that people understand that. And I was just looking up the definition, but I mean, it's failure to observe the ordinary course of care. I mean, it's a very low threshold. That's why we arrived at the gross negligence. So I'm just trying to get my fingers around how this amendment would impact how the company thinks through things, and how this whole bill will, frankly. But maybe you could just, John, explain a little bit more about that, because I think these were some of the concerns that you had talked about before.
Senator Huggins, through the chair to Senator McGuire. As a longtime Alaskan, I share the frustration that we all had over certain recent events. But, and so I do understand. I think I signed my name to a letter saying I understand and respect bringing this forward. But my mind is 10 years ahead. My mind is in another basin, perhaps out in Bristol Bay area or Copper River. My mind is on a new operator coming into the state, trying to figure out how taxes work in the state of Alaska. And the thing that I did want to point out and feel obligated simply to bring to you, and then it is that this is rather novel in my experience, based upon relations that exist between the companies themselves. If a company is guilty of willful conduct, the others don't contribute at all. They're on their own. They lose any deduction. If they're guilty of gross negligence, they lose that ability. Certain conduct also is deemed in the law to be deserving of treatment for strict liability, as Senator McGuire identified, and an example of that is in Section 16 of the bill right now.
Right.
It says, if you have hydrocarbons and they get loose into the environment, we don't care why you did it. I mean, yeah. We don't care how careful you were. If it happened, you're not going to get any deduction. The only thing that I am attempting to identify right here is that This is rather unusual to zero in on negligence, which is, at the top of the heap is willful misconduct, and then there's gross negligence, recklessness, and those things normally are disallowed among partners or perhaps even under the tax laws. But ordinary negligence is a way of saying somebody made a mistake. And, I mean, we can think in terms of companies, but often these are young Alaskans up there working that get training and they're supposed to do something, and they'll put the in fact, we had an example of a blowout preventer that had been installed backwards. And you do something often enough, and that can happen, and our testing picked that up. But that was a mistake. It's picked up, and I think we need to keep in mind that oil field safety should be our primary concern, prevention of waste of hydrocarbons, and the only reservation I have on a policy level, is and I'm trying to point out, is that this might provide a certain incentive to some operators to continue to operate when the most prudent course of action, the preferable course of action that they might otherwise have selected, would be to pull that car off the road, figure out exactly what's wrong, get it fixed, and then get it back on the road again.
Senator McGuire.
Well, and just following up on that, and this is what I've been trying to say throughout, and you said it so eloquently, it's that we have in our minds right now a party, and we just received an email about that, and we have a lot of emotion about it, but what we're trying to do is enact a policy that is going to get us through the years and is going to strike that appropriate balance and relationship that we have as a state between those that invest in and develop our resources. And my concern is simply that, you know, the memo, for example, and I guess this, Senator Wagner, is to you, the memo that you distributed to me, that is gross negligence. That's intentional and willful misconduct. If you can show evidence that a company, whoever that company may be, knew about and consciously disregarded known risks and went the other way, that is recklessness. That's the standard of gross negligence and recklessness, and they're all melded together in common law. But that said, that negligence is a very low standard. And so I guess I'm still stuck on this point that if the word gets out, well, it could just be kind of a common mistake. Just keep plowing through then. I mean, let's not stop and call any attention to what we're doing here, even though we're not sure. We're afraid we might have made a mistake. We want to stop, pull the plug, and shut down and sort of see where we are. I'm nervous that it's going to send the wrong message. But
yeah, Senator Wagner.
Mr. Chairman, just let me put this in a different perspective. And we can talk here all day about this, but this is no different than having a 75,000-mile warranty on a vehicle. And I pay for that warranty as part of the purchase. But when I pay for that and I sign the papers, I also agree to do certain maintenance on that piece of equipment. If I blow that engine at 69,000 miles and I have not changed the oil properly or done proper maintenance on that engine, I go into the dealership and Mr. Chrysler is going to say, "What are you talking about? I have the maintenance on your vehicle. I have the warranty. They don't match up. They will not replace the engine in my vehicle because I did not properly maintain it." That's what we're talking about right here. Not gross negligence or anything. It's talking about improperly maintained.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we don't mention negligence anywhere in here, just kind of a point of clarification. But aside from that, we're not putting anyone in jail. We're not fining anyone. We're offering an incentive. We're saying if you have good oil field practices and you don't and you take care of your property and you maintain your property, we will allow you to deduct a significant deduction. However, if you don't do those things, then we're simply not going to allow you to deduct it. I think that is a common sense policy for the state to adopt.
Well,
I'm sorry, Senator McGuire.
Well, then on that point, then you're right, we're not talking about negligence, but the problem is that you imply certain things in the statute when they aren't said. So then we should say intentionally improperly maintained. I mean, we should imply a mental state then. If you're saying that it's not negligence, it is negligence. I mean, you know that. You know that negligence is the implied mental state if you don't state one. And we have already said gross negligence is automatically excluded. So what we're talking about now is the lowest threshold. We've excluded anything that's by gross negligence, and we haven't implied a mental state, so we are talking about just failure to observe ordinary care.
Well, if I could respond, Mr. Yes. Chair, was directed to me. What we're talking about is a lack of or improper maintenance, and we're looking at good oil field practices in making that determination. Is that, I'm not prepared to say that is the legal definition of negligence, but I don't have a problem with saying to someone that lacks improper maintenance or completely just ignores maintenance that you don't get a tax deduction for that. I don't have any problem at all with that, even whether that's negligence or whether it's good oil field practices or what. I have no problem with that at all. I think it's a good policy for the state to adopt.
Well, the element that keeps coming back, and I'll just read it, says, or equipment shutdown. And that's the part. Clerk, please call the roll.
Can we have an at ease?
Could we?
Yep, at ease. To restate the amendment, if you go to line 26, Bowlegs Bravo would be deleted down to line 28 at the end of semicolon equipment. Questions? The clerk, call the roll.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator McGuire?
Yes.
Senator Wilkowski?
No.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Yes. Okay, motion carries. Okay, other comments or questions of members on the bill? Senator Green?
Has there been any effort, because I think I missed a couple of the hearings on this bill, to balance out the new language with the and the lack of deductions with the 30-cent per barrel? Because in recalling testimony last year, it was clearly the connection was in that vein. And I was wondering, is this going to continue to be the standard with 30 cents?
We have had some conversations on that. And there's two memos from Pedro Van Meers. And as I recall, the Commissioner of Administration or Revenue essentially said there wasn't any connectivity. I think we have since then potentially some language that might dispute that. And I don't, Senator Stedman, I don't know whether you have that with you or not.
Well, what we did, and I think we need to go through my understanding of what the Commissioner of Revenue brought forward was the transcribed minutes. If you go back into the meeting of the 7th, I think it was, amendment on August 9th, amendment number 7, and transcribe the actual conversation. I think it's a clear tie-in, and that's how I recall it, which was, I think, different than Senator Wagner dealing with why the 30 cents is even in there as we worked right through this process last year.
Right.
I'm sorry. And there does appear to be more connectivity between the two when you read the language. And Senator Wagner.
I'd like Mr. Bullock to address that because there is no connection between the two.
Mr. Chairman, this has to do with legislative intent. And legislative intent's a tricky issue because it goes to what's in the mind of the people that voted at the time. What did they have before it and what they can consider? Looking at the minutes, I don't believe that the confidential memo that was not released until this year could be considered to figure out what the legislature intended when the amendment was offered by Senator Wagner. before the Natural Gas Development Committee,
yes,
whatever the name was.
Special Committee on Gas.
Super Committee.
Yeah.
Supercharged Committee.
You can rationalize what happens and what words mean afterwards, but if you're looking at what the intent of something that passed the legislature, you look at what was available, and there's no mention of negligence, there's no mention of a standard of care being a linchpin for determining whether something would be deducted or not. So I don't believe that there's any history in the minutes that I've seen or elsewhere, and I've searched the PPT history,
yeah,
trying to find some explanation of it. Now, the irony of the 30 cents is the worse the repair, the slower the oil flows. Since the floor is 30 cents times the production, that it allows actually more costs to be deducted than are allowable when the oil slows down. So in a way, the 30 cents has a downside too.
Should that be corrected, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Say that.
Should it be corrected or changed?
It's up to you folks.
Good. Senator Stabman.
Mr. Bullock, did you go back and listen to the actual meeting, or did you just read the minutes transcribed?
I read the minutes, and I read the sponsors' comments that are in the minutes. When you're doing legislative history, you have to rely on what's readily available to the public.
I would suggest that the minutes are listened to on the August 9th, particularly Amendment Number 7, the actual voice and discussion from Van Mier's.
It does allude to some interconnectivity in his testimony. When you
would only even get to the legislative intent to the extent that it's in conflict with the written discussion that's in the minutes and the language of the statute itself. To the extent that it's unclear, you can look at the intent. But if the wording of the statute itself is clear, then that's the first approach to it. And the statute under the 30 cents doesn't talk about the level of care that's expected. It talks about terms of repairs and replacement and how those costs should be treated and deducted.
Did that answer your question, Senator Green?
No.
Could you give that one more shot?
Well, because the 30 cent provision sets a floor, so the first 30 cents multiplied by the production says that that's what the operator's going to have to pay. This doesn't rise to the level of deduction. It's not a deduction until they rise above the 30 cents. So you take 30 cents times the production, and that's the floor. If your production's low, you're multiplying the 30 cents by a smaller number. So that means more costs above that. You're disallowing a smaller amount of cost because the volume's down. I don't think if you have a problem with that or you want to change the policy, I don't think you can do it just by simply moving the words around in that sentence. What this bill does is it approaches the problem from another angle, and that's by disallowing costs that are related to this lack of or improper maintenance. So this is saying these costs aren't even deducted because that 30 cents applies to costs that would be allowable, not costs that aren't allowable. And this bill would make certain costs not allowable, so not even subject to that 30 cents.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
I understand what Mr. Bullock is saying, but the discussion back when we were looking at these different amendments was how to deal with concerns from Alaskans as to whether the replacement of pipes and complete significant overhaul of Prudhoe Bay could result in very significant tax breaks. That's a direct quote from Van Mier's. And as we work through this policy call, either by using the language where we do the negligence issue and we have a lot of potential disagreements between the industry and the state over what should or shouldn't be deducted. I recall the compromise solution was to come in with the 30 cents and clean the matter up. And clearly if for some reason time goes on, and certainly 30 cents per barrel as production goes down, your gross deduction goes with it. And if it goes up, it goes up. But that was pretty clear that we were looking at the total production in volume and not trying to isolate individual fields.
Yes, Senator Wagner.
Mr. Chairman, I take exception to that comment because I happen to be the maker of the motion. The 30 cents was to bring us closer to a gross bill than a net bill. That was the sole purpose of the 30 cents. And Pedro Van Meer said that's the best way he could figure out to bring us there. And that was done in consultation with myself and two other senators in my office on the Saturday that he wrote that memo on, which I think was the 5th or the, I can't remember, I've got them all here. Had nothing to do with pipelines and corroded pipelines. That was, this 30 cent amendment was crafted before BP made their announcement. And if you look back on the timeline that I distributed here, that's very obvious. You can follow it right down date for date for date. The BP shutdown happened on the 7th. Pedro's memo to me was on the 5th. So we had already crafted that 30 cent amendment 2 days prior to BP announcing the shutdown and talking about the corrosion, the bad corrosion on their pipes.
Senator Wagner, what Senator Stedman's talking about was on the 9th of August, Pedro Van Meer's testimony, so it was subsequent to the shutdown.
Well, it's kind of the chicken or egg, Mr. Chairman.
No, I understand, but I'm just to put into chronological context, it was after the shutdown. So that when Pedro was testifying, I wasn't there for the testimony. I just saw the text before that it was in that context. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to realign the argument, if I could, the 30 cents applies to a floor on costs that are allowed, and the bill that you have before you says that certain costs are not going to be allowed, so they never even get to the 30 cent issue because they're not something the state, if you adopt the bill, is willing to share the cost of.
Yeah. Let's take a brief at ease. Intent, and I think each member now should have a copy of the August 9th testimony transcript of Mr. Van Meer's. And if you would, Senator Stebbins, would you, there's a couple of pertinent parts, I think, that sort of allude, if not directly get to what Pedro was saying, at least on that day.
All right. This is transcribed by my staff of meeting took place on August 9th, 06. Amendment number 7, and it starts off, the first paragraph is with Senator Wagner, and then the next, and then Meer's testimony. If I could just read the first couple of sentences, and then I'll jump down, but it says, with great pleasure to give a little bit of background on this amendment. I think over the last few days in particular, there has been enormous concern expressed among Alaskans as to whether the replacement of pipes and complete significant overhaul of Prudhoe Bay could result in very significant tax breaks or very significant deductions. So that was clearly on the minds of us as we were sitting around the table. But at the bottom of the first page, that sentence jumps in. So consequently, the easiest thing is to simply say, okay, we take some base off of capital, some base expenditure that really will be replacement in the future. Probably the oil lines will have to be replaced, or other facilities or equipment or pumps would have to be replaced. And we, over the next 20 to 30 years, that we hope Prudhoe Bay and other fields will still produce. And he's a non-American, so sometimes there's a little bit of difficulty in the flow of the language. And it is much easier, rather than debating forever between the auditors and the oil companies whether something was repair or something was betterment, it is much easier to simply say, okay, we will simply disallow modest floor of capital expenditures. From an international perspective, 30 cents a barrel taxable production seems to be a reasonable number. And he goes on and talks about that. But anyway, it was definitely on the minds as we sat around, as I recall, sat around and dealt with these amendments and tried to come up with a compromise, both in and out of the committee.
Yeah, Senator Wagner.
Well, I'd just like to go a step further and say there's some words that are missing there that are in this amendment, and that was not maintained or was improperly maintained. That's the crux of the matter. That's the bottom line. That's where this gets to.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Well, and there's also a statement a little bit further down here on, I guess it's page 2, where he says, and that would guarantee Alaskans that under this PPT bill there would be no credits, say, for replacement of the pipe that some Alaskans are worried about. And if this was done a couple days after the BP pipe had...
Sir, where are you?
Yeah, would you point that out to us?
Yeah, that's this...
Is it the third page?
It's the...
That would guarantee...
Eight lines down on the second page.
Oh, yeah. And it's maybe not even halfway down.
Oh, it starts with the sentence, and that
starts
would.
Starts with, and that would guarantee. Yeah. Oh. So I guess one way you could look at that is if this happened on August 9th and the BP pipe problem occurred a couple days before that, I would presume that would be the pipe that Alaskans were worried about. And here he's saying that there would be no credits for replacement of the pipe. I wasn't here for the debate, so... That is an interesting statement.
I also recall when we talked about that 30 cents, it certainly wasn't a 30 cents for 1 year or 30 cents for 3 years. It was a 30 cents to run in perpetuity against the life of the field. And certainly some years it's going to be favorable to the state, and some years it probably wasn't or wouldn't be.
Hey, Senator Green, you're the one to ask the 30-cent question.
I am so happy that I did that. I didn't know what I was getting into.
Other comments on 30-cent or 40-cent? I think some of the things we're touching here, some people would describe as dead horses, and others would call them, you know, Arabian horses that run as fast as in the world and should be fed. I'm not sure what the right answer is. That Senator Wagner, do you have any more comments on this bill?
Well, I was looking for my memo from Pedro Van Beers, but I don't seem to have it. Oh, wait a minute, here it is.
You sure did earn his $1 million, didn't you?
Here's the last page.
While Senator Wagner's looking for that, I'd just like to remind people we announced informally that 186 will not be heard today. So for those that are online, 186 will not be heard today. But thank you, and we'll get the announcement out when it will be heard. Yeah, I'm sorry. House Bill 186 is the Sport Fishing Guide Records.
That's all right, Ms.
I'm sorry?
No.
Other comments, questions?
I don't want to belabor the issue.
Anybody in the audience want to speak to Senate Bill 80? Okay, with that, do we have a motion?
I'll go ahead and make a motion that we move bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And a version.
Is there objection?
Version, what's that?
Hearing none, the bill will move to its next committee of referral. Next, Senator Wilikowski, natural gas for state residents, SJR 4.
Yes.
You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mary.
Do you want a motion to adopt the CS, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
I move that we adopt the CS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 4 /Lima.
Okay. And with that, is there objections? Hearing none. SJR 4 is before us. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. This arises from the escalating costs of natural gas in the Cook Inlet area, which provides energy. Cook Inlet provides natural gas and energy for approximately 473,000 Alaskans, which is about 71% of the state's population, and to heat their homes and businesses. These goes from Fairbanks to Kenai, Matsubura, Anchorage, of course. And as we all know, there is a request to extend or rather to go to FERC to have an extension of the Kenai liquefied natural gas plant. They seek to continue an export license so that they can continue to export natural gas overseas, and by federal law they're required to go through a FERC application. There is an application. The administration has placed a set of conditions that they would request be met before the application is approved, and this is simply asking FERC to do a couple of different things. Essentially, look at the natural gas supply that exists in Cook Inlet, and we all saw a poll that recently came out which said that I think 89% of Alaskans believe that maximum use of our natural resources includes providing low-cost gas for Alaskans. And so this resolution asks for a couple different things. Number one is to urge the producers in Cook Inlet region to work with local utilities to ensure an adequate and affordable long-term gas supply. Number two is to we also urge the Regulatory Commission to expedite the review of any utility contracts. We also ask the Department of Energy to, when reviewing the extension application, to consider whether the needs of the people of the state are being met for the natural gas. And we think this is important. We've got a number of different organizations, NSTAR, Chugach Electric, ACPERG, AARP, that have submitted letters of support on behalf of this measure. It's an important measure. I think it's important that we stand up and show Alaskans that this is an issue that we're concerned about and we're doing something about. And we're not saying that we don't believe the Kenai liquefied natural gas plant is not important. We do think it's important. We just want to make sure that Alaskans, and we think it's only fair that we ask that Alaskans' need for natural gas be looked into, considering that this plant exports about 36% to 39% of all the natural gas in Cook Inlet. We think it's only fair to do that. So respectfully request your support for this resolution. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. Our questions or comments to Senator Wilikowski? Senator Wagner?
I have no problem with the resolution. There's a couple things I'd like to have maybe Senator Wilikowski look at making a little change in it. But the one thing we need to remember, you know, we've had a lot of hearings here about gas and availability of gas and pricing of gas. I'm not sure even if Phillips plant closed down tomorrow, if that would have an effect on the price of gas in Cook Inlet. Because currently the gas in Cook Inlet that is supplying the utilities is under contract for a specific amount of money.
One is based on Henry Hub, and one's maybe 80 cents less than Henry Hub price. Those are the two major contracts, one with, I think, Chevron, and the other with Marathon. So when we talk about affordable, I'm not, and I'm paying my bill too, and Instar says that all of their customers pay at the same rate, whether they're on the Kenai, or whether in Anchorage, or Wasilla, or where. So we all pay the same rate for an MCF of gas. So I'm not sure we're going to have any chance to get more affordable gas, because we also are tasked with getting the market value for our gas. And I don't know whether the legislature can put out gas less than market value. So that's one thing. The second thing is in line 13 of page 2, the resolution talks about 58 residents of the LNG plant, and that's true. That's in the LNG plant and in the operation of the platform, which is called the Tyonic platform. But that's only a portion of the jobs involved with that plant, because on the other side you have Marathon, who is a partner with ConocoPhillips. They have many more employees than these 58, probably 100 to 150 employees that are exploring and producing currently the gas for the other side of that plant. And they produce probably over 50%. Mr. Norman know better than I, but I think it's over 50, around 55, between 55, 56%, I think, of the gas produced and goes into that plant is by Marathon Oil, not by Phillips. So I'd just like to see those changes made or addressed.
Yeah, if I could just, Sean, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Wagner. My office would be happy to work with your office to try to come up with language.
Okay.
We purposely put that in there on line 13 through 15 because we do recognize the importance that this plays, and we're not saying don't do it. All we're saying is let's take a look at how this will have an if, in fact, it will have an impact on the residents and businesses of South Central and actually all throughout the Rail Belt.
And one other thing, I agree with what he said, but one thing else we've got to think about, and I know Phillips and Marathon are thinking about this, if, in fact, that plant shut down, they would have to do something with that gas. It would probably go into storage, because if they shut down the production of those wells too long, Mr. Norman can come up and tell you the problems they run into when they shut down production of a gas well. And none of it's very pretty over a longer period of time. So would you like to talk about that, Mr. Norman?
Like it or not, here he comes. Good to have you, John.
I am realizing now the danger in hanging around.
Yes, you are.
Mr. Chairman, this is his real...
It has been asserted, that's all I could speak to, is that there could potentially be a conservation issue if those reservoirs were shut in.
Put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Norman. I'm chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Based upon our review of that petition, the commission did intervene in the proceeding to extend the license so that we could monitor that situation. And I believe it would be inappropriate for me to go beyond that, because at some point we may have to make a judgment as a commission on how we would manage gas production throughout Cook Inlet. I'm not suggesting that's the case now, and I don't know. I don't have the facts to represent to you one way or the other, except I can tell you that in the pleadings that are filed to extend it, ConocoPhillips has and Marathon have at least put on paper that if they didn't have that outlet for the gas and it was shut in, that it might give rise to a conservation issue. I don't want to align myself with that position, and I'm not in a position to dispute it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Norman.
Thank you.
We have Ms. Rita Hatch
prepared to speak to this? And Senator Wilkowski, are there any people in the audience that can speak to your resolution?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that, Ms. Hatch, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Would you please put yourself on the record, and we would be pleased to hear your testimony.
My name is Rita Hatch. I'm a 40-year resident of Alaska, and I've been on the heating program ever since I moved to Anchorage 10 years ago. I understand from what you're saying that we're just not going to get the gas because they've already contracted it out to somebody. Well, I thought it was Alaskan gas, but I guess it isn't. If we let them just give the gas or sell the gas to other countries, we're not taking care of our Alaskan people. And I don't see, you know, it's our gas, isn't it?
Correct. Except for those elements that have been contracted, and we have a contractual obligation.
But why is that allowed to happen? If you know you're short on gas, why are you giving it to other people when we need it?
No, I understand. Senator Wilkowski, you want to address that?
Oh, I'll take a stab at it. That's what we're trying to resolve. We're asking... We're asking FERC to look into whether or not the license should be extended, and one of the things we're asking them to do is to look into whether or not the needs of the people of Alaska are being met before we go ahead and agree to this application, before they go ahead and agree to this extension.
Well, I agree that their needs are not being met, and I don't see why we should let them sell gas to other countries.
Your point is well taken.
Yeah, Senator Stebbins, then Senator Wagner.
Well, I think... To partially answer the issue in Cook Inlet, it's definitely a concern. We've had several meetings on Cook Inlet supply, and where replacement would come from, either through LNG or a line from the North Slope, or coal gasification, or more exploration and development in Cook Inlet. So it is a concern of the legislature that we do everything we can to help, with that situation. But now that the market price more reflects, or actually the price for the customer more reflects market prices, I think we're going to see more interest in Cook Inlet trying to expand the gas supplies.
Senator Wagner?
What that means by the price of gas reflecting the cost, I don't think it does. I think the price of gas that you're selling to your customers is way over. I mean, you're making money. You're making lots of money at the expense of the poor people who are trying to heat their homes.
Yeah, Senator Wagner.
One thing people need to be aware of, and there's not much information out on this, two, maybe three times, I'm not sure the number of times this past winter, ConocoPhillips made the decision that they shorted their supply of gas to their plant in order to supply gas during a projected period where there would be a peak demand. And that gas was given into the system so NSTAR could meet their peak demand over and above the contract that NSTAR had with both Chevron and Marathon. So they don't not recognize the situation, and they do respond. And, you know, they're a pretty good neighbor that way. And so basically what they do is they short the amount of LNG they ship throughout the year by supplying the gas when the peak reaches the point that the existing production that is a non-commercial production, so to say, is met. So that has taken place. The people of Alaska do take precedent in a way over shipping gas to Japan, let's say.
Right, and the price went up at least 30% in the last 3 years. So they're not hurting by selling it to Alaskans either.
Let me tell you one thing. We aren't paying $14 per MCF like some people in lower 48. Alaska continually has the advantage of the cheapest gas available in the United States, including...
Yes, but we have the most gas of the United States, too.
Yeah.
So we should get it cheaper than anybody else.
Ms. Hatch, thank you very much for your testimony, and the essence of Senator Wilikowski's bill is getting at some of the issues you have. But we thank you very much, and stay tuned, because we're in tune with you and trying to get at some of the elements that would get you cheaper gas, or at least a guaranteed supply of gas, whichever, or hopefully both.
Yeah, both is what we need.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Hatch.
Thank you.
And next we go to Mr. Curtis Thayer. Hello, Curtis, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, Curtis, Charlie Huggins here. Put yourself on the record, and you've got a minute and 30 seconds.
Okay. My name is Curtis Thayer. I'm the Director of Corporate and External Affairs for NSTAR Natural Gas. And NSTAR Natural Gas represents over 125,000 meters, or 340,000 Alaskans. And we support Senate Resolution 4, encouraging that the state of Alaska, the RCA, and the utilities work together with the producers to come up with a solution to ensure long-term stable gas supply here in Cook Inlet and at a fair price to the consumers. That's for short.
Very, very good. We appreciate your brevity. And Ms. Hatch says she wants some sort of economical gas heat supply, but I know that you're working hard on that, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to set this bill aside and or this resolution, work out some of the details as we've discussed. We will now go to Senate Bill 57, Marine Parks Edition, Hunting Allowed. I like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kim Elton, Senator from Senate District B, which is Juneau, Alaska. And I will be brief. I'm not going to reread the sponsor statement. The bill, in essence, is almost self-explanatory. I just want to say that the nut of the bill is that it adds additional islands to the marine parks here in the Juneau area. And those islands are, for the most part, very small islands. They stretch from the edge of Auk Bay north to the base of Lynn Canal. And the islands are frequented by locals, by Southeast Alaskans, and by visitors who move their boats up to Southeast Alaska. The islands are all, most of the islands, there's deer hunting, there's fishing adjacent to it, there's gathering of subsistence foods, recreational activities such as picnicking and camping, and of course there's commercial fishing in the waters adjacent. What happens with the addition of these areas, Mr. Chair, is that outdoor and recreation and hunting groups can partner with the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation in the Department of Natural Resources, and sometimes at no cost, sometimes at minimal cost to the state, facilities such as cabins, outhouses, boat ramps, other things that make these areas more accessible to Alaskans can be added and enhance the area. I will note, kind of for the record, that one of the islands that is being added is Coghlan Island, which has recently been in the news. It was the island upon which my former colleague, your former colleague, Representative Bruce Wyrock, was able to survive overnight. And I think it's a testament to his skills of living in the outdoors that happened. Finally, Mr. Chair, before we enter into the question phase here, I just note that we haven't found any opposition to this. Territorial Sportsmen supports the bill. They're one of the groups in the region that does work with the state to add enhancements to state park lands. Southeast Alaska Land Trust supports it. Gold Belt, which is our local corporation here that is involved in timber, involved in mining, involved in tourism, supports this. The CBJ Assembly, I think, has, you should have in, as part of your packet, a resolution in support.
There is one inholder in this area. That inholder is supportive of the legislation. And then the State Parks Advisory Board also is supportive. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm open to any questions you might have. I will note for the record, and it's something the committee want to consider, if you turn to page 2 on the bill, section 2, it provides the commissioner may not prohibit hunting within a marine park unit of the Alaska State Park System, and then as commissioner may not restrict, and then there's existing language, fishing, hunting, or trapping rights permitted under law or regulation. We're talking about here about the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, not the commissioner of Fish and Game. And there was an amendment added on the House side in the companion bill that adds another layer of protection. I mean, I think it's already protected, but that protects commercial fishing in the waters adjacent to the islands that are being added. I don't think it's needed. If it gives the committee an additional level of comfort, I certainly have absolutely no problem with the additional language being added. And we can provide that language to the committee if you are interested in doing that.
Okay, quick questions for the sponsor. If I might, Senator Elton, I see that the Outdoor Council, Territorial Sportsmen, who you mentioned, Gold Belt Native Corporation, City and Borough of Juneau, some charter organizations, Juneau State Parks Advisory Board, Southeast Alaska Land Trust, and Southeast Alaska Conservation Council all support the bill. What are the restrictions that apply when it comes under the state park provision?
They're as applied to the existing marine park.
Right.
I don't know of any, but I think there is somebody from the department in the audience that may be better able to address that question, Mr. Chair. Okay. And you can take that person's advice with much more than a grain of salt, which you'd have to take it with.
Any man that wears a Columbia or Warwick shirt can't be all bad.
He could envy you.
Yeah.
With your collection. Yeah. Yes.
For the record, I'm Mike Eberhardt, Park Superintendent for Southeast Area State Parks. The issue of restrictions on lands, state lands, once they become under the jurisdiction of, I guess in this situation, it would come under my jurisdiction. The state marine parks are open to, as you see in here, the hunting and fishing, and that the main restriction that we do is we make sure that anybody who wants to commercially use a park or do resource extraction, we don't allow that sort of activities within the marine parks. That's why, I mean, it's difficult for me to go beyond the statutory mandates of what the marine parks are set out for. And these are very specific. That's what Mr. Elton has done in stating that it's hunting and fishing that are allowed there. And so that the one thing that people would probably be more limited on is like fire pits. We would allow people to just indiscriminately do fire pits. The resource protection for the future is our main emphasis that comes out, and we're more proactive about making sure people use proper etiquette in their use of the resource. So that's where we have regulations that talk to using fire pits, to not vandalizing and removing trees within the parks for firewood and stuff like that. Other than that, it's especially for these bills, the marine parks are pretty much open to any non-commercial use. As soon as it's commercial use, they would have to go through us and meet those statutory requirements in order to use the land for some commercial use.
Any restriction on aircraft?
No, actually, they're specifically open to aircraft in most.
The blue and white aircraft.
Blue and white ones in particular, right?
That's right.
I'm sorry, Senator Stedman?
Yeah, the language on page 2, line 13.
Give us just a second to find that.
Sure. Page 2, line 13. Talks about Shelter Island. And
and the language is, the following described parcels excluding submerged lands seaward of 20 fathoms of barometric lines. Why was 20 fathoms selected versus 10 fathoms, which is clearly delineated on a chart, most charts, just by color?
Yeah, I'm looking at the brain sitting next to me, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, maybe Mike can respond.
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair. That's basically the big impetus there was to not garner a lot of water under the jurisdiction of state parks, that we concern ourselves almost entirely with the uplands, and so that normally we would designate a park unit via aliquot parks, just the square blocks of land. And in this situation, in order to encompass, just the way they're laid out, in order to encompass all of the uplands, there was huge blocks of water, and that caused a lot of concern back in the early attempts at getting this into legislation with commercial users and other users of the waters, that state parks could come in and at some point restrict the use of those waters because it didn't meet the statutory reasons for making the park. So we have restricted that down to keep the acreage as small as possible of the waters that basically aren't going to impact the use of that one.
But 10 fathoms is shallower than 20 fathoms. And 10 fathoms is clearly delineated on the charts. And it'd be easier for people to know when they're in the park and out of the park. And so I'm just kind of curious, and most people, when they anchor, try to come in at 8 fathoms, 6 fathoms, not at 15 and 20 fathoms, especially out in the terrain there where you have deep, deep trenches.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, through Mr. Stedman, or sitting through the chair. Once again, when we were, it was strictly a administrative of drawing the lines, and that instead of doing the aliquot parks, we could have chosen 10 fathoms instead of 20 fathoms, but at the time, that wasn't, there was no intent that I was aware of when we were drawing those lines to include or exclude whether the anchorages or not, because we were trying to exclude as much as possible. So whether we should have gone with the 20 or the 10.
Senator Wagner?
If you're trying to be to exclude as much as possible, and I have a little bit of experience dealing with state park, what I call catchback state park, why wouldn't you just make the park boundaries mean low water? Why put any water at all into the park boundaries? Because then what you get into is the more areas involved, the more controls people want to exert. And right now, I have a lot of unhappy people from time to time because there's more water, I think, in the Ketchikan Bay State Park than there is land. So why do we want to put the water? Because the water is already controlled by
Yes, Senator Elton.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, Senator Wagner, I'll attempt to add it, and Mike can jump in. I mean, as part of this discussion, I mean, I think 10 fathoms makes sense, and if the committee wanted to consider that, I'm sure we could get together and we could figure out why that doesn't work. It makes sense to me for a couple of reasons. One is, as Senator Stedman has noted, most people who anchor in the area are not looking to anchor in 20 fathoms, especially if they pulled the anchor themselves by hand. And it also makes sense because the 10 fathom line is clearly delineated on marine charts, and that makes it easier for people to assess where they are and where not. I will attempt to answer Senator Wagner's question. I think that it makes sense to include adjacent waters when you're talking about a marine park, because one of the issues is anchoring buoys, other things that may or may not need to be added to enhance the park and make it easier for people to use. And so while mean low tide does restrict it even further, I think it may place some, it may make some park enhancements in the future a little bit more difficult.
I think on marine buoys, though, aren't those required by the Coast Guard? Before you can put a permanent buoy down, you had to have a permit for that, I believe.
Mr. Chair, that is true. I have to confess that I have had a buoy out in front of my home for a considerable period of time.
Hear ye, hear ye.
I would like to think there are very few scoff laws, and I would be the lone example of a scoff law, but there are others.
Senator Stebbins, next. We're going to 2 minutes and 39 seconds. We're done for the day, okay?
Okay. On line six, where it says the commissioner may not prohibit hunting within the marine park, should we have hunting and fishing? So if you're trolling, you can troll in by the beach and chase the silvers or whatever you're doing?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem with that. Something along those lines, I don't think that was the exact language, something along those lines was added to the House Companion Bill, and I think it's kind of a restatement, but I have absolutely no problem with it, and it probably makes it clear. We'll get the language.
Two questions, we'll be out of here, and we'll bring the bill back. First one, if I'm Troop Bravo from Kodiak, and I come out, and I've got 20 kids and a scoutmaster, what do I have to do to go camp?
Use the facilities that are provided or talk with the if you have greater than 20 is you're right on the line there. If you had more than 20 people, you're required to talk with us and get a permit in order to assemble within the park. Fewer than 20 people, you don't.
I got 25. How much does it cost me?
It doesn't necessarily cost you anything. We allow nonprofits and most users like Eagle Beach State Park, we don't charge the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Boy Scouts, any of those for assembly. We strictly want to know that they're where they're assembling so that they don't interfere with the normal use of the park units. That's our main.
Okay.
I would just add, Mr. Chair, interference with other park users is often not an issue in these small islands that we're talking about.
Okay, my final question has nothing to do with the animal other than just the example. Chugach State Park, which I assume is managed under generally the same parameters, the question of trapping wolverines. We're not going to have a wolverine trapping problem in this area or some other critter that somebody wants to trap, are we? Because it is excluded under 1949 rules?
I'm not familiar with the trapping rules, but as of right now, we don't have a big trapping issue out in the marine parks. So... Yeah, I
don't look at me. We're
not going to, as a general rule,
anyway,
avoid that as much
more to follow. We're adjourned. Thank you.
It's all your fault.